And we're just after the top of the hour. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Chapter 5, Part 2, with Elise Lonsdale on behalf of the Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired. I actually feel like saying welcome to Discovery 2, Chapter 4, because I thought it might be prudent to go over some of this IP stuff and binary stuff. Just a bit of a review before we go into the next section of the chapter. And it occurred to me that there are some very well written and sort of talks about the classes of IP addresses and a number of other attributes about those very, very well in the Discovery 2 curriculum. So I went and looked up Discovery 2 Chapter 4 and found it all. So I feel like saying that that's what this lesson is. Not really, because that also covers subnetting because it is more advanced than this curriculum, and we don't cover the subnetting here. They do an exploration, of course, so if anyone wants to know about subnetting, either dig up one of the older lectures or have a look at Kerry's exploration course. Usual question, gang, is, how are you, magic students?
Fine, thanks.
Fine.
Cool. All right. Fine.
Pretty well.
I know, spoken to Marshall and Kimmy, of course, all morning, so I know that you two are well, but it's nice to hear you well for the recording. And let's hope people out there in listening land are good too. Marshall raised an interesting question before the exam has bailed out. He closed the browser when sitting the exam, and I've got to go and reactivate it. So just be careful, guys, try not to do that, because it's a fiddle to get these things restarted. Cisco don't make the website to particularly good in that respect. Are there any questions on the material thus far from any of the modules?
No, except that I hope this gets easier. The binary stuff, I mean.
So do I. We'll see what we can do to help you out off channel. It's a concept that is tricky. It's tricky to teach. It's tricky to understand. And I really can see why the people have difficulty with it. But, you know, if it's taught the right way, it's going to minimise some of that. In actual fact, again, Jackie's lecture from last year really, really did it really well. If I could do the job half as good as her, I'd be happy. Well, which is another reason we're trying to keep the breaking points exactly the same so that you can mix and match the lectures. If you've heard part one of this particular round of lectures, you can mix and match that with the part two from the version of the course that Jackie and I did 6 months ago now. Chapter 5 was the addressing, or is the addressing chapter in the Discovery 1 curriculum. And as we know, what's another name for an IP address, gang?
A logical address.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for, as opposed to the physical address on the Mac, which is the MAC address on your hardware. Why do we need an IP address?
Well, you don't get on the network without one.
Yep, it's one of the reasons.
For other computers to identify us and other devices.
It's to identify also to which network we belong. Where we are on the network is really the MAC address. All right, so that's why we have IP addresses. Now, last week we also discovered that it's a hierarchical system, and you can equate prefixes and area codes and phone numbers to IP addressing, or streets with houses along it, for example. So we know that, you know, for example, if we wanted to think about it as, what's a good point? Maybe my area here in Melbourne. I'm in the eastern suburbs, southeastern suburbs of Melbourne. The part of my phone number is 9807. Now, that means that covers parts of what used to be called the Jordanville area, which is now parts of Mount Waverley, and parts of Chadstone. A friend of mine down the road, who Narissa and Kim know, Vicky, actually has a different prefix. She's in Chadstone. However, the last four digits of her phone number is exactly the same as mine. And then we did that for our business partnership we had several years ago. And as such, it's like having two, let's say we had an IP address at Narissa's house and an IP address, you know, a private IP address at Narissa's house and a private IP address at my house. They could actually be the same because the two networks, they're non-routable. So therefore the 192.168.0.1 or whatever the address happens to be wouldn't cause an IP conflict because they're behind the network address translator. So, you know, you can do that sort of thing. So the last four digits of Vicky's phone number is exactly the same as the last four digits of my phone number. But the earlier part, or as you move out towards the left of the phone number, is different. So, you know, we can say for Hamilton, Ontario, for example, most of the left-hand parts of the phone numbers there are 90, 905, And then as you go further towards the right of those phone numbers, you get the individual, people and their individual phone numbers. So there it goes, and that's similar to the way IP works. Any questions so far? Okay, we also learned that there were three main classes or five classes of IP addressing under the IPv4 system. And can anyone tell us what they are?
Well, this class A, B, C, D, and E. A and B are commercial. C is small, home office networks. D is, one of them's broadcasting addresses and one's for emergencies.
Not quite. Experimental, actually. The
experimental.
E for experiment.
Oh, look, it's too early in the bloody morning.
Well, the coffee hasn't kicked in, Auntie Narissa.
No. I knew it was experimental. I'm saying the wrong things.
E for experimental, not E for emergency.
Exactly.
The first two, you're almost, we don't actually express it like that, but it is one way of expressing it. A, B, and C. A and B are, well, sort of commercial, but we really express it as I guess you can say they're all commercial. It's not so much the fact that whether you're a big business or a little business, it's how you want to divide up your network. It's just that the A, because you can have more hosts per network, the A's are used by larger companies. The B's are used by larger companies and say, people at home in the small office, home office environment, or the Soho environment, as we were listening to on the weekend, gang, is traditionally going to use the smaller groups, which is your 192.168 Class C type addresses. Now, one of the things that we didn't do particularly well last week, partly because I was a bit worried about this binary conversion with the Windows calculator, I just found it easy to do it manually. I since had a bit of a shot at the Windows calculator and found that on this system it doesn't seem to be in the least bit friendly. I must try it on the 64-bit machine, but Kerry and the others advise us, it is accessible under Windows 64, 32-bit, Windows 7. Yeah, well, I'm glad it is. It doesn't seem to be that particularly good here. However, I have another 64-bit machine with which to try it, so I will stand corrected if I'm wrong. It was just a bit of a shame because it was quite good under Windows XP. It didn't seem to be any of this sort of hassle. And I'm talking for JAWS users here. Narissa's probably done it graphically with the Zoom text. And I know you submitted your worksheet the other week, so that's all good. So we'll continue to look into that. The binary conversions we might even play around with a little bit later, but one of the things that we didn't actually go into particularly well last week because of the way the notes were as well was of these A, B, and C classes of addresses. And it really has to do with the what we call the first bit of the first octet, or the what we call the high order bits. And I'm going to see if I can translate a table to you, because we should also advise you that the IP addresses can range from 0 to 127, or usable 126, but we'll come back to a reason why we say usable, but 127, 0 to 127. For your Class A networks. For your Class B networks, they can go from 128 to 191, and for your Class C networks, they can go from 192 to 223. Now, these are interesting numbers because if you translate those out to binary, any number from 0 to 127 in the first bit is always going to be a zero. If you, for example, translate any of the numbers from 128 to 191 to binary, the first two bits in the first octet are always going to be one and zero. So I'll say that again. If you translate any number between 128 to 191 to binary, the first two bits are going to be one and zero. If you translate any number between 192 to 223, which is your Class C group, the first three bits are going to be 110. So there's a pattern. 0 for the Class A, 1 for the 10 for the it's going to be 10 for the class B and 110 for the class C group. And the reason it's like this is because what the router does, and this is only a newer thing that's come in since they brought in the class system, or when I say newer, probably in the last quite a number of years, but it was sort of added on to this. The router looks at the first bit and goes, what is it? Oh, okay, it's zero, so I'm going to think no further. We must be dealing with class A. It's going to look at the first bit, and if it sees a one, it's then going to look at the second bit and see that it's a zero and say, oh, I'm dealing with a class B network. Oh, a router could look at the first two bits and go, well, that's a 1-1, so I better look at the third bit and go, oh, that's a zero, so I must be dealing with a class C network. Now, in doing so, the router can then, make its forwarding decisions. And yeah, basically the whole thing just makes a little bit more sense to the router. Now this is another reason why I think it's a good, I'm also answering Scott Marshall's question from last week, is why is binary so important? Well, this is another reason why. The other thing is, of course, is that humans can't think in binary, so we like to translate those out to dotted decimal notation for the ease of, typing in our IP addresses. So that's another reason why binary is so important. Before I get on to how many hosts we can have per network, are there any questions?
I'm still a little confused. You're just looking at the two bits of the highest of the first octet, or are you looking at patterns?
No, the first one, two, or three bits of the first octet. So if you see a 0 or a 127 in your first octet, let's say you had an address of 127.0.0.1, which is the local host address. You should expect to see a zero at the first part of that address. Or better still, if you had an address of say 192.168. dot something or other, so that would be in the range of 192 to 223. So if you look at your first octet, can you visualize that, Marshall?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, if you convert 192 in the first octet out to binary, you would get a number that is 110 something or other, and I'll just quickly do it. You get the number of 110000000. So the first three bits, two of those first three bits are set to one, and the third bit is set to zero. So you're always going to find the first three bits in a Class C IP address are always going to be the same. The first three bits in the Class B IP address are always, the first two bits in the Class B IP address are always going to be the same. And the first bit in the Class A range of IP addresses are always going to be the same, irrespective of what the other, the other bits happen to be in that octet. Is that making sense?
I'm going to have to do some studying, I think. I mean, the concept makes sense. I'm just trying to figure it out in my head.
Yeah, you've sort of got to, I guess if some ways, if you can imagine a row of numbers, like a row of an IP address, let's say we'll do one, 192.168.1.1, for example, might be a good one. Imagine stacking the binary numbers under each of those groups of numbers, for example, under each octet. You understand that 192.168, for example, are two octets?
Yes.
Right. So if you could visualize, are you a Braille user by any chance?
Not a good one.
Okay. But if you could sort of, whether you do it by your sense of touch or do it by any, I don't know whether you could ever see it all. There are some people here who are congenitally blind, others aren't. And even the non-congenital blind people like Jackie, for example, she mentioned last year, would still visualize stuff. I'm not sure. Were you born blind, Marshall?
Unfortunately, no. I lost my vision about 10 years ago or so.
Oh, okay. Well, then you might, I don't know, can you still visualize things?
A little bit.
Yeah, it's a sense I would hate to lose if I went totally blind. Sorry, I cut you off. What was that?
Oh, I'm just confused. I thought the IP address, the class of the IP address was assigned by the subnet mask.
I will come back to that. But yeah, the default subnet mask anyway. Yeah, absolutely, it is. It has to do with it anyway. As to the classes, the high order bits are usually what the router looks at, because the subnet mask itself has to belong to a class. If you could imagine, say, 192.168.1.1 written on a piece of paper, and visualize that in your mind if you can. I know some people do lose that skill after they lose their sight. And under each of those octets, you write your eight ones and zeros, or your eight bits, whether they were all ones or one or zeros or a combination thereof. So under each octet, you write a separate group of eight groups of numbers, or each of your eight bits. Each group of eight bits, or each lot of eight bits, might go under your decimal version of the number. Can you sort of imagine that?
I can.
All right, now in your mind, just like an old card file thing, flick over numbers from, 192 to 193, 194, 195, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you don't have to know, but imagine the binary digits under that number changing, if you can. Imagine in your head that those numbers are changing. If it was sort of like an old card clock radio or something, where, for example, the cards might flick and you see a different number, and you might eventually see it flick all the way up to 192. 195 or 196 or 197, etc.
Yeah, I see the pattern.
So
only the lower order bits.
Yeah, the bits are the IP address is going to. The binary version of that number will change, but always, irrespective of how they change or what they change to, the first three digits are going to be 110.
Okay. I was just confused about the effect of the subnet mask.
Let's have a look at this. No, that's all right. Well, let's have a look at the subnet mask, because I'm not sure whether anybody remembers. It's a good segue into the next section. Does anyone remember the default subnet mask for a Class C network?
255.255.255.0.
Exactly. Okay. Can somebody then tell me the first, the default subnet mask then for a Class B network?
For A class, did you say?
No, for Class B, Nerissa.
255.255.0.0.
Yep. So therefore, if anyone can start seeing a pattern, what does anyone think? Have a guess if you can't, if you game. What is the default subnet mask for a Class A network?
255.255.0.0.0.
Exactly. Now, can anyone tell us why we see this pattern?
Is it...
Go ahead, Marissa.
No, you say it, Marshall. That's okay.
Well, don't they just logically AND the subnet mask with the IP address to get the...
If you want to find out the network... if you want to find out the network address.
That's the word I was missing, network address.
The network address, yeah. Now, if we get, for example, the figure 255 dot... Hang on, I'm just looking at some of my notes here. Just bear with me for a sec. Okay, so we know that we've got this business of, let's say, for example, with the Class C network, the first eight bits are set to what?
Bits or the high order bits?
Now, I've just made a mistake. Now, I'm talking about the subnet mask here too, by the way. The subnet mask of 255, so let's look at the subnet mask, right, which we now know, because we've just decided this in class, that we're not going to worry about the suborder bits, the high and low order bits yet. Let's have a look at the address of 255, where we know the binary number is all ones. The reason we know that is we have to go back to our binary conversion chart, and we'll run through that again in a minute and we'll prove that, but just take my word for it, that at the moment the 255 is always going to be eight ones, okay? Now we're not talking about the IP address here, we're talking about the subnet mask. Now, if we have a default subnet mask of 255, which is eight lots of ones because I said so, and if we go back to our binary conversion chart or Windows calculator, it'll prove me right. Then how many bits is that, gang?
Eight.
Yep. So now if we have a 32-bit IP address, whether it's a 32-bit IP address or 32-bit subnet mask, they're both 32 bits because they line up. How many bits are left for your host?
Which class are we talking about? Sorry.
Still on class A, sorry. So we're just working with this class A subnet mask. Now, Marshall's just told us we know that there's 32 bits in the address, and Marshall's just told us that there's 8 bits in that particular subnet mask. How many bits are left for the host?
That'd be 24.
Yep, 24. So we now know that in order to make a class A network function, we need a default subnet mask that's going to give us 8 bits for the network and 24 bits for the hosts. Is that making some sort of sense? Evidently not.
No, yes, we're following that, yep.
It is.
Yeah, you're following. Yep, okay. So, Marsha was asking about does the subnet mask actually determine what class of network? No, not really. The class of networks is determined by those high order bits. They don't teach it in this course because it is a bit complex. So they just tell you in this course that you're going to deal with a default subnet mask. And if I remember reading the course curriculum correctly, I might be wrong, and I'll stand corrected if I am. It doesn't really tell you why. It just tells you that it is. And if you want to know why, go do Discovery 2, I guess. So if we have 24 bits for our hosts and 8 bits there for our network, what does it really mean in practical terms? What does it really mean?
The number of hosts you can have in a Class A network, in a Class A network.
That's right. So which incidentally is about 16 million of them. So 16,077,216. Yeah, well, exactly. In actual fact, that's addresses. That figure I just gave you is addresses, and we'll have a look at the slight discrepancy between addresses and hosts in a minute. So, yeah, exactly. So it tells us that, you know, you can have a lot more hosts out there than if you had a look at the Class B network. Now, let's have a look at the Class B network, gang. And I think Narissa told us before that the Class B network has a default subnet mask of 255.255.0.0. Did you not say that, Narissa?
Yes, I did.
So, based on the fact that we know that there's 32 bits out there to play with, how many bits are in the first two octets of that subnet mask?
16.
Yay, she's got it. Because we know that all 255 is all ones, so you just add them up. Now, if we had some weird number like 255.25, I'm just going to have to go, I hope I don't get this wrong in my head, 255.254 or even 252, we would have something like 14 or 15 bits, because what would happen is that in the second octet, there'd only be 6 or 7 bits. So every time we set a bit to zero, we actually increment down the subnet mask by power. And I don't really want to go too far into that yet, but you can have custom subnet masks that are, if you look at it from a binary point of view, let's say for a Class B network, actually it would officially be a Class A network now, but it would be all ones in the first octet and maybe 14 or 15 ones in the second octet. And that would translate to a 248 type number, depending on how many bits you had, or even a 240 number, and then .0.0, of course. So you would end up in a situation of a Class A network with bits being borrowed out of the host portion, and that's getting a little bit complicated for what we're trying to do here, and we might even experiment with some subnetting at some point, but basically that's a Class A network with extra bits, a bionic Class A network. So you just really in the subnet mask, they're just adding up all the bits. That's why it's important to understand this, four lots of eight business to get your 32. So if we, for example, wanted to make a if we wanted to make a add some bits, we could actually have 17 bits in a subnet mask, which would take us into the next boundary, and you would have a class that would officially be a class C network with bits borrowed from the host. So that's a bionic class B network, if that makes sense. So you don't necessarily have to have 8, 16, or 24 bits in a subnet mask, but for the discovery run curriculum who's teaching basic IP addressing, that's why you have 8, 16, and 24 bits, because those bits are always going to be relating back to the decimal, going to be set to any degree of amount of ones. Are you following that, Marshall?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's a mongrel of a job to teach it. It's a mongrel of a job to understand it, and you've got my full permission to go out there and get it all wrong there. All right, so where was I leading up to here with all this? I sort of got a bit, little bit digressed into a bit more bits than I originally wanted. So what I was about to sort of say before we jumped into that little bit is that 2^7 is 128, for those of you who care to remember, and that means you can have that amount of number of networks in your class. Class A, I think. Yes, you can. And I'm not sure whether I've actually got this bit right. Sorry, Kerry, if you're listening. But because I'm just looking at this table I googled up before. But you can have the basically what you need to know at this particular point is that in the Class A system, there's less networks, more hosts. In the Class B network, it evens out a bit. And in the Class C network, you can have, looks like here, 2^21 for number of networks, which is a big fat number. And you get 2^8, which is, yeah, there it is, 2^8, which is, anybody, if they care to remember, is 256. And that's how many addresses you can get out of your class B networking. Again, lots and lots of networks and not so many hosts on each network, or in this instance, I'm talking about addresses. Has anyone actually picked up on the fact that I'm referring to addresses and hosts? And I'm trying not to get them mixed up.
Yes.
Okay. Can anyone remind the class why?
Isn't the there's the broadcast address, isn't the doesn't it always have to be all ones?
It does. There you go. And all ones are what?
255.
There you go. So if all ones are 255 and we start at zero, we have our highest address on that segment has been 255, as Nerissa just said. And that's why we start at zero. So that's why we have 256 possible ones. Now, the other thing, of course, is there's one more. We actually have, as we might remember from our notes, actually 254 possible hosts. So we've still got one other address to deal with. What is it?
The loop back address.
No, there is a.
I'm trying. It's something I know, but I can't think at the moment. One's a
Yep.
broadcast address. And the other one's the identification of the network, isn't it? Like all zeros?
Yep, all zero, so we refer to it as the network address. There you go. Geez, you guys are good. So, if we have a Class C network here with 256 addresses, as I said, I was referring to addresses differing from hosts. We now know that the one that's set to all ones is 255, which is going to be the broadcasting address. We learnt that, I think, either last week or back in Chapter 3, sending a broadcast message has got all ones in it. And if we want to, and then we still need a network address. So out of any network or any network segment, you're going to drop two IP addresses just to have it there in the first instance. So, Kim, how are you coping with this? It's difficult, and you and I have got the privilege of being able to cope, do this privately. But is any of what I actually said to you in this class made any sort of sense, or have we wandered off to the kitchen to get a cup of tea?
Sort of making sense, but I have to sort it out later.
Yeah, a lot of it's got to do with visualization. That's why I'm often interested in as you've worked with me on many projects now, I often teach differently for sighted folk. I often teach differently for vision impaired folk, and I often teach differently again for totally blind folk. And then I often start getting a bit more complex and go, well, who here is congenitally blind? Has anyone ever been able to see? And the reason is for what I did for Marshall before, because if you can stack some numbers up on top of another number and then sort of imagine that one number changing, it might have a profound effect on the number beneath it. If you're talking about putting the decimal number on the top row and the binary equivalent on the bottom row, and that sort of those sort of teaching techniques tend to sort of make a difference. So yeah, that's fair enough. Well, you're doing all right. How are you coping out there, Pat?
Sitting here with my cup of tea, understanding. Thank you.
Lovely. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Yeah, so it's some people get it, others. I've had to study Carey's curriculums. I've had to study it off line online. Jackie and I did a whole lot of study on it ourselves out of the course. And I think, you know, it's some people relate well to some instructors, others relate well to other instructors, others relate well to studying by themselves, and all of a sudden the light bulb goes on. Look, I'm not brilliant at maths. I'm a school dropout, and I'm proud to admit it. You know, when you have my education, you'd rather not. Well, no, it's really harsh, but suffice it to say, I didn't do very well at school at all, and here I'm being an instructor, so there you go. If I can do it, anyone can. All right, I'm just going to look at my notes. I did actually sort of digress a bit here. Here we go. Just going to find where I'm in the notes, because I did a whole patch job from reefing bits out of that other curriculum. So that's where we wanted to start at. We wanted to sort of have a bit of a look back at this. I've lost track of the time because it all gets interesting, and it's 8:40 in the morning Melbourne time, so we better get moving. All right, so I've already said these IP addresses are hierarchical, which they are. It was basically decided to divide the networks into a manner that would make it easier for routers and hosts to determine the network IDs, etc. And this is why we talk about those high order bits. Now, I don't think you need to know the high order bits for the exam. I'm pretty sure you don't. The reason I brought it in here was because I thought it might prove why we've got these different classes of IP addresses. So I'm not expecting you to remember how many, you know, what are the first two, one, two, three, or etc. IP bit high order bits are going to be. It's just that I used it as a tool with which to demonstrate why we have these different networks. But I do need to tell you something that you will need to know for the exam. So listen up. Okay, I've pasted that paragraph back in. Okay. As we know, with the class A network, the first octet denotes the network address, and the other three octets denote the host's address, right? Now, as the host portion is the correct way of saying it. We know that. We've discussed it. Okay, any bit of the first IP address, any bit of the first octet with a class with a zero is a class A, which you probably don't need to know for this curriculum. Okay, but what you do need to know for this curriculum is that class A addresses have in its first octet a range of 1 to 126, or really 1 to 127 is what I usually tell people. So to see a class A IP address, it's 1 to 127, okay, in the first octet. A class B in the first octet has how many bits for the network, guys?
128 to
191. 16.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, come on, Nerissa, go for it. Why don't you take my job? Correct answer is 16. Thanks, Marshall. And they are therefore going to mean that there's 16 bits to define the host portion and 16 bits from the host from the network, of course. And as they are that will have a number of 128 to 191. As you just said, in the range. So if you look in an IP address and you see that it starts with 128 in the first octet, 128 to 191, and you see an IP address floating around out there, you go, oh, that's a class B. Because you do have to memorize those, unless you want to sit there and do binary with every time you see a number, and you don't, because you people are all sane and you don't want to go mad. You do have to remember those boundaries. 10 or 1 to 127 is your class A's. 128 to 192, as Nerissa rightly said, is your class B addresses. So, therefore, Nerissa, how many bits in the network portion of a class C IP address?
You're asking me, yes, 24. Wait a minute, in the network portion, 24.
In the network portion, yeah, I'm only talking about the network portion here. So therefore, because you were so eager off the mark the last time around when we were discussing the class B one, do you know the numbers? Because I know you've also set the exam, and well done, by the way. Do you know what the ranges of numbers are? Yep.
192 to 223.
Very
sorry,
good.
192 to 223.
Yep, there you go. So if you see an IP address out there that has any number in it from 192 in the first octet we're talking, 192 to 223, it's a class C. So does anyone answer anyone's question as to why they've been going, I wonder why I've got a class C address at home? There you go. Because A, it's in that range, and B, we want lots of networks for, you know, little amounts of hosts. So there you go, that's why it happens. Class D, I do believe, is here, and it goes from, just as a matter of interest, you may need to know this for the exam, if you see a number with 224 to 239, I believe it is. And I don't know these off the top of my head, so I'm just going to take these notes here.
I think that's right.
Is a class D. And it says here in my notes I stole from Discovery 2, the first octet's going to have a 1110 as its high order bits. But I don't think you need to know it for this curriculum, but I just thought I'd tell you just for the heck of it. The class E, I'll see if I've got that here, is 240 to 255, and we can't go any higher than 255, of course. So if you see a number with a, you know, in its first octet with 240 upwards, that's a class E. And they've even got the high order bits here too for that, just in case anyone wants to know, which is 11110. There you go. Now, we're going to see these out on the internet, aren't we? And we're going to go, oh, wacko, my address, especially if I'm in Australia, is 203 dot blah, 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 dot, dot, blah, 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 dot, 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 blah, blah, blah. And I just went and did the discovery course with Elise, and she said, oh, that's a class, you know, that's a class, you know, C network, et cetera, et cetera. You can't have that out on the internet. No, it's because the class system, in many respects, is not used. So if you see these addresses out there, like I think I saw an IP address coming in from Kim in Canada, and I think she was 71 dot something or other. Out there in the big bad internet, they're not using the class system. It's just that we still teach it because it helps people in the learning process here. Okay, so I could just see that question coming. Am I making sense?
Probably good you told us that, because we might have wondered.
Well, if you go to IP, what's my IP.com? What is my IP.com?
Yeah, exactly.
It'll tell you. Yeah, it'll tell you what your public IP address is, and you're going to go, oh, well, oh, I shouldn't have that. I'm on the big bad internet, and I've got this class C internet. How the heck does that work? And you'll go, this discovery is a crock. And no, it's just that they're not using the class system there. In addition to creating the separate classes, the good old IEFT, whoever they are, there's some mob, decided to allocate some addresses for private networks. Woo. Okay, private networks. They're the little networks we have here at home on the what side interface of our routers, gang?
Like on the near side.
Near side, there you go. So, which means, guess what? It means your computer at home, Nerissa, can be on the same IP address as my one at home here. There you go.
Yeah, that's right, because they're like private ones, aren't they?
Yep, exactly. Okay, and it also says here in the notes, which is actually correct, thank you, Discovery 2, that private IP addresses are not, I repeat, not to be routed across the internet. There you go. This allows multiple networks in various locations to use the same set of IP addresses without creating addressing conflicts. Woohoo. There you go. All right. Now, there's some stuff here about other addresses set apart for really, really private use, like 10.0.0.0. I'm not sure that you need to know that in this curriculum. I'm starting to get a bit blurry here as to what you should know and what you shouldn't. I'll have to look at the exam. There are private IP addresses in the class B and C range too. The PIP addresses that the Microsoft give you out if you can't find a DHCP server. I think fall within those other classes, class B. Okay, so we're going to start talking about DHCP. Nerissa, what's it stand for?
Dynamic Host Configuration DHCP Protocol.
Control Protocol. Some people say configuration. I think the official one is control, so either is right. I'll buy either. Okay. Most consumer-based products will do what? Hand out DHCP addresses. Only devices that are connected to the internet are assigned internet addresses. Routable internet addresses. Okay, now I've got here another table. Okay, it basically tells us here that the class A can have an address of 10 point... it gives us an example. I'm not sure the examples are typically a good one to read you. Look, it basically probably doesn't relate that well to me speaking it, but basically if you see an address of 192.168.0, you're going to end up any address from 192.168.0.0 to 192.168.255.255, it's going to be a class C address with a default subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. It's going to allow you to have 256 networks. It's going to allow you to have 254 hosts because you've got two addresses pinched. And the total host out of all of those numbers would be actually 65, 65,024. So let's get out of the mathematics and come back to something a bit more sane like DHCP. Okay, as you know, a router provides a gateway. See, we can get sane there. A router provides sort of a gateway from which the hosts on your network can communicate to hosts on other networks, for example, the internet. Okay, each interface on a router is connected to a different network. And this is important. Each interface on a router must be connected to a different network. Kim, I love you. Probably shouldn't say that in class, but who cares? Can you tell me what two networks you would be connected to?
Right now, I would be connected.
Yeah, your router would be connected to you. The router. Oh, let's remember we have some interfaces on our routers.
Okay, I'd be connected to my Ethernet or my local area network and my wireless network, although the wireless is switched off.
Almost right. Almost right. Okay, let's have a look at this. One, yep, you are connected to your local network, which is on the near side interface of your router. Yep, so you got the first part of that absolutely right. Let's not talk about the wireless network for a bit. So excluding the wireless network, what other networks do you think you might be connected to?
I'm not sure what, I don't know what the part of my router that's connected via Ethernet would be called, because I'm having a brain fart, but that one.
Okay, no. All right, we'll stop you there. The part of your router that's connected via Ethernet is the near side or the local network. So whether you're talking about your Ethernet cable, your near side interface, your local network, you're talking about the same stuff. Okay?
Okay.
Yep, so it makes sense. So I did actually say you were connected to two networks. The other network therefore must be, use some process of elimination. how do we get this? You're going to hit me when you work it out.
Give me a hint or tell me, I can't think.
You do a lot of stuff on it.
Oh, anyone I don't know.
It's big, mean, and nasty. Anyone else want to have a go?
The internet.
There you go. You got there. Well done, hon. You got there. The other network is the internet. Or if you're in a big company, the other network may well be, like, say, where Marshall works, may well be another network with, you know, on another campus or in another part of the same campus. But in your case, it's the internet.
Oh, so I was counting that in my... I was counting that in with my local area network, not in the local network, but in the... never mind.
That's all right. Well, let's have a look at the router. Hello, Gypsy. Okay. Oh, hello. Hello, darling. You being a beautiful putty? Let's imagine
the router.
Hello, Gypsy. Auntie Nerissa says I should turn the speakers up. Probably recognise Nerissa's voice. Okay. We've got two networks here. That's what a router really does. It only joins up two networks. It can be any two networks, just for the sake of this conversation. It gets one network and links it with another. That is essentially the job of a router. It gets traffic off one network and routes it through to another network, hence the name. Okay. Is that making sense, Kim? Okay, so do you understand the concept that I've just explained to Kim here, that you've got two networks?
Yes, I understand that, yeah.
Yep, and that's what your router does. Your router connects one network to the other. So, this is going to make this whole thing fall into place. Come on, Kim, where are you? Okay, the thing that I wanted to explain to Kim, and this is where a lot of people get confused, so I can see exactly why Kim said what she did about the wireless interface, is that the wireless interface isn't a different interface. Woohoo, the thought plickens. Okay, so when Kim incorrectly answered that question before and she said, oh, well, I've got two interfaces, I've got my Ethernet one and my wireless one. No, the wireless is on the same interface as your Ethernet network, and which is why I was looking for the answer that the two networks involved here are the local network and the internet, or the local network and another network, if you happen to be where maybe Marshall is. And there's a reason for this, and this drops it all into place quite well. The reason is because the wireless network is only really another port on the switch. Remember how back in Chapter 3, we discussed the fact that your integrated services router has a switch in it as well as a router? Does anyone remember that?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. So you have your internal network, which is your four cables coming out the back of it, or as many as you want to use, and your wireless network are all on separate ports of the switch, which is connected to the near side interface of the router. Aha, uh-huh. How many pennies have dropped here?
That makes sense.
So it's very, very easy, especially for us kinesthetic people out there, to pick up the integrated service router that we got from our favorite department store and go, oh, it's got four ports, wacko, I've got a four-port router here. No, not quite. You've actually got a router with two interfaces coupled up to a switch with four visible ports. because that's what they sell. And then they say a four-port router, oh, well, yeah, Harvey Norman, get your four-port router, blah, blah, blah. They're actually incorrect. Technically, from a purely technically point of view, they're actually incorrect. The marketers are incorrect. What they really try to tell you is that it's actually got a switch in it. This is your integrated services router thingy that you get. And basically, the access point, the wireless access point, is connected to port 5 of that switch, which you don't actually feel because it's inside the box. Pat, how are we going with that?
Understand, I have one of those creatures.
As do I. Actual fact, I've got a separate router, and some of them have a modem built in. Now, where do you think the modem's going to be in relationship to the router, gang?
It's on the far side, I think.
You're right. There you go. It's on the far side. You guys are working all this out for yourselves. It's on the far side interface of the router because you go telephone point, modem, router, switch, and computer. Okay, back to the official notes. But I think it's prudent to point those things out because it's going to help you in the exam. I wish I knew this sort of stuff when I was a student. All right. Okay, now it says here in the notes, getting back to the function of a router because that's what we're really doing. We're doing our IP addressing bit here. We are saying that with the router, every host on a network must use the router as a gateway to other networks. Well, of course it does. That's why we have our default gateway. So we're using the router as a gateway to other networks, and we're using the router as a gateway to the internet if we're on a small office, home office environment. Therefore, each host must know the IP address of the router interface that it's connected to. So basically, every host must know that IP address, or else it won't be able to get out. And it's known as the default gateway address, which is why we have to hammer in our IP address, our default subnet mask, and our default gateway address. Or else we can actually hammer in a custom subnet mask if we carry and do subnetting, but we're not going to today. Now, these three entities, the subnet, the IP address, the subnet mask, and the default gateway, are often put in manually, but can be actually assigned by a DHCP server. Okay, so being putting in manually is referred to as static, being statically assigned. It doesn't change because the network administrator came along and typed it all in. Or it can be dynamic, which means it's assigned by the local DHCP server. When an integrated router is configured to be a DHCP server for the local network, it automatically sends the correct interface IP address to the default gateway address to the hosts. Okay, and I mangled that up a bit, but I don't like the way this is reading. Okay, so because each host has got the default gateway address, it can therefore forward packets out to the system, can forward packets out to another network on the internet. So without the default gateway, you could talk internally. Kim could example, we have two computers on a network, not assigned a default gateway address. They could talk to one another, but you wouldn't get the internet. Okay. Okay, most DHCP servers are configured to assign private IP addresses to the hosts rather than internet routable addresses. Okay, so the DHCP server is assigning a pool of private IP addresses to the hosts on your local network. Now, of course, using the private IP addresses means that the private network is not directly accessible from the internet. And in the case of a home office business, etc., in this context, these addresses are usually Class C addresses. Now, internal hosts must be assigned network addresses in the same range as the router, or within the same network, actually, is what it says here, which is correct. It has to be on the same network or on the same network segment as the integrated services router. All right. Okay, as I've already said, it also provides subnet mask and the gateway. Now, this is important, this bit, because an integrated services router can actually act as both a DHCP server and a DHCP client. And here's the reason why. On the near side, it's acting as a DHCP server to give your local computers their IP addresses. On the far side, that's connected to the big, bad, nasty what?
Internet.
It then acts as a DHCP client because under most conditions, the IP address that's assigned to you by your internet service provider is dynamically assigned. So it says, oh, I'm a DHCP client. Please give me an IP address because I'm trying to log on to the internet. Okay, so these integrated devices can act as both, and I have a feeling I did see that in the test, but I could be wrong. Remember gang?
There was something like that in it, yes.
Was it? Yep. Okay, so your systems, I'm pretty sure there was, because I went through the test about a year ago when I qualified as an instructor, and so I haven't really looked. I really should have looked at this. I was going to, and I ran out of time this morning. So, it's doing both jobs. And it says here the far side is often referred to as the external side or something. Okay, that's repeating what I've said, but using different words. Oh, yeah, I was just going to tell you, folks, the English teachers have got to this course. That's why the notes are so repetitive and verbose, and they don't tell you a great deal of stuff. That's why I had to nick out to Discovery 2 to get you that information on the higher order bits. And also, they are out to get you in the exams. The English teachers are really, really on patrol out there, and it's just one little word here and there that can automatically, so quickly change the meaning of the way you perceive the sentence is written. Okay, an internet service provider usually provides an internet routable address to people who are connecting. Now, the integrated router can serve as a boundary between the external network and the internal network. There are several ways a host can be connected to the internet, and whether a host is provided a private IP address or a public one depends on that the way that's connected, and I'll explain this. Oh, here we go. It actually tells you in the notes. It's been a while. A direct connection, say like what Kylie had up until 12 months ago, means that Kylie just got her modem, plugged it in the computer, and got on her Windows and went, "Windows, please make a connection." If that happens, you then get a public IP address directly to your computer. Wacko. Yep, you'll get on the net, you'll get your email, you'll be able to put stuff up, you'll get your web pages, but guess what else you'll get?
Attack.
You got it, both of you, Nerissa and Marshall. Yep, you'll get attacked or you'll get viruses. Okay, and it says here in the notes, so for those of you who, and we all know, everyone's out there reading their notes, hopefully prior to class too. It talks about the direct connection. It says some customers have got that. Look, even some of your basic modems you're getting for $30 or $40 now are offering NAT in them, network address translation. I think this one does. I had to sort of bridge it all out when I connected it to the main system. So, yeah, I think it was all there. But the original, my original broadband installation I did way back when, and Vicky and I did way back when involved a, it involved a D-Link ADSL modem with a USB plug on it, and you plugged it in the computer, and the computer went da-dung, found new hardware, etc. And you used the dial-up, sort of a dial-up networking scenario with an icon on the desktop to connect to the internet, and there you go. Nice big fat public IP address for you. Wonderful. Okay. If we connect through an integrated router, all that goes away, and you end up having a private address for your near side stuff, and you still have your public address, but it is blocked off from you. So what do we do? We've got these two IP addresses. We've got this public IP address that we got from the ISP. It goes through our integrated router box thingy, and we got these private addresses. How do we translate them? We introduce the concept of network address translation, which offers you some protection against attacks just by the default, by the fact the network address translator is there. You can do nice things with it. Basically, if a packet's not, even attack is sent to that public IP address, for example, the router is going to drop the packet if it's not one that's requested. So if we go on a web page, on a website, and we request a website, the router goes, okay, the internal computer here at Kim's desk is on 192.168.0.2, and it requested a web page from our favourite radio station, which is at the moment CHML in Hamilton, and the web page comes up because that machine requested it. The router went, okay, this is a legitimate request. Let's translate that request to the public IP address, which happens to be 171 dot something or other. And the radio station, if they're keeping logs on their website, will see a request from Kim's public IP address, 71 dot whatever dot whatever dot whatever. So it sends the packet back to that. Kim's integrated services router goes, oh, okay, here comes the page that's been requested. So it's coming in from whatever the address is from the radio station, and it will translate that back to her private network address of 192.168.0.2, because that was the machine that requested it. Now, her girlfriend Shannon might be over at the time sitting on 192.168.0.3, but because Shannon's machine didn't request the website, but Kim's machine did, it's going to route that packet through to Kim's machine, right? Is this making sense?
Yes.
Yep.
Kim, is that making sense? Yep, making sense, Kim, and it's making sense to you, Pat, so that's good. Okay, so we got two people on Kim's network, Shannon and Kim, and Shannon's sitting there doing something else, not requesting the radio station, but Kim is. So the router now knows to send it back to that computer. But what happens if Mr. Hacker comes along that's not been requested? It's going to fire off an attack at the public IP address of 71.whatever.whatever.whatever Kim's address is, right? It's going to fire off an attack there because Mr. Hacker's nasty. What's going to happen? Because nothing requested that packet on the near side part of Kim's network.
Well, the network translation sort of nullify the packet or stop it from getting through.
Yep, Marshall said it in one word, and Nerissa said it in more than one word. Yep, it will get dropped, actually. It just gets the packet gets ignored or gets dropped. So that's how network address translation can offer some protection. There you go. The other thing about an integrated services device, of course, is that it offers you to have a create a home or small business network because they usually come with a 4-port switch in them, and that's how you can share it out. Yes, you can directly hook up your computer via a dumb modem to the internet and use internet connection sharing, which is the way we used to do it on the dial-up system. And that's no different, by the way, than just adding, you know, plugging in a dial-up modem through the old serial port and connecting through the dialer, etc. That was, you know, giving your computer a public IP address and away you go. But internet network connection sharing would allow you to share it out to one or two other people on your network. We don't do that anymore because everyone goes out and buys integrated services routers or the like. So there you go. So it's much more convenient to do it through the ISR. Okay, gateway device combine an integrated router and a modem in one unit. That's a gateway device. Now, here we go. Now up to the bit in the notes where it does talk about network address translation. So it basically says in the notes, since private addresses aren't allowed on the internet, a process is needed for translating those addresses, you know, between private and public, and that is known as NAT. Or network address translation. Okay, it basically says here with NAT, a private source IP address is translated into a public routable network internet address. And the process is reversed for incoming packets. That's what's going on here in my scenario from CHML talking back to Kim's computer. All right. Only packets destined for other networks need to be translated, which again, in the case of Kim's looking up the radio station, is exactly happening. It's translating the packet from her local network to the public network or the internet. These packets must pass through the gateway where the integrated router will replace the source host's private IP address with that of the public IP address. So as far as CHML are concerned, it only sees a request from Kim's from Kim's public IP address. It replaces the IP information in the packets. That's what a router does. It gets a packet, looks at it and goes, oh, I need to replace some information here. It unencapsulates it and re-encapsulates it again. Okay, and it's saying here that all these hosts are sharing the routable internet address, which is fine, which is what we're doing with our device. There's a diagram here, and I'm going to skip bits of it because I've really told it to you. There's some diagrams here, look in the notes. They do get a little bit repetitive, unfortunately. And it explains how the source address is changed as it gets to the gateway, and it explains how it's changed. But I've basically said that. The source address of the packets that have been sent out from Kim's machine, which include the requests for the website. Remember, Kim's got to request the website, are being translated. And the source IP address changes in those packets as it goes through the gateway. The web server responds to Kim's request, or in the diagram scenario here, to the Linksys router, which is really what it's doing. It's responding to Kim's router, Kim's system, and sends back the page. All right, we're up to the chapter summary, but before that, are there any questions? Okay, does everybody get how the wireless network, even though it's you think of it as a different network, isn't really a different network?
Yes.
Because if it was a different network... Yep, because if it was a different network, it wouldn't talk to your other local computers. If you've got a wireless computer sitting, as I have over here, my wireless, the Triple E, for example, would talk to Enterprise here because it's on the same network segment. So it's all on the near side interface of my router, the wireless, and the 4 bits of Ethernet cable, etc. Okay, in this chapter, we learned a number of different things. Without an IP address, a host cannot participate on the internet or any other network for that matter. It discussed the importance of internet IP addressing and the fact that it's a hierarchical structure thing. Each logical IP address is made up by two parts. Can anyone remember what they are?
The
network and the host.
Yep, network and the host portion. Yep, that's it. And an IP address is a series of what?
Octet numbers?
Yeah, it's one way of looking at it. Oh, 32 binary bits, it says here in the notes, which is really what it is, 32 binary bits. We break it up into octets, which is 48-bit bytes, which are called octets. We learned that those four octets are each converted into a decimal number, so the computer only sees, 110... 00 1100 dot ones and zeros. But we can't think like that because we lose track of our ones and zeros, so we convert it out to decimal. And that notation is referred to as, does anyone remember what that notation is referred to as?
Dotted decimal notation.
Thank you, Nerissa. Yep, exactly. Dotted decimal notation, because it's got decimal numbers in it and dots in it. Okay, the IP address and subnet mask work together to determine which is which portion of the network, which portion of the IP address represents the network portion, and which portion represents the host. IP addresses, we learnt in this chapter, are classed in many different ways. They are five classes, that being A, B, C, and D, and E. And the way to remember this, it actually says here, class D is for multicasting, but class E is for experimental. So if it comes up in a test anywhere, E is experimental. Each of these classes of addresses actually have their own default subnet mask. Please don't ask me what it is for E and D, because I really don't know. But we know what they are for A, B, and C, of course. Can anyone remind us?
A is... Oh, I think I need a coffee. A is 255 and three zeros. B is 255, 255 and two zeros. And C is 255, 255, 255 and one zero.
Thank you, Nerissa. Exactly, and it's because when it's translated as binary, all those 255s are ones. Oh, eight lots of ones in each bit, in each byte, sorry. We also learnt that public addresses are unique and used on the internet. Private addresses can be used by by hosts in many organisations, but private addresses have to be translated to internet routable addresses in order for you to be communicating on the internet. IP addresses can be signed either dynamically or statically, of course. Incidentally, does anyone remember Dora from last week?
Yes.
And that basically is Kylie's little thing that sort of says about the... how it's discussed, and this I think was somewhere in the notes actually. It sends a host will send out a discover message looking for a DHCP server, and what was the O standing for, Nerissa, do you remember?
Offer, wasn't it? Was it offer?
Yep, that's right. That's it. Thanks for that. A DHCP server will come back and offer an address, and what was the R for again?
Request.
That's it. Then the computer will, your host will actually request that address. It's been offered, so it makes a formal request. And the DHCP server acknowledges that address, hence the A. D-O-R-A, which is discover, offer.
Offer.
What's the
request.
R? Sorry. Yeah, request. Discover, offer, request, and acknowledge. Discover, offer, request, and acknowledge. And I do think that's in the test. So there's one for the English teachers. They didn't think that one up, so, yeah.
Yeah, that was clever of Kyrie to think that up.
Well, I would have thought it was, exactly. And I think with these acronym people out there or et cetera, they would have come up with that. But yeah, it was very good of Kylie, wasn't it?
I found it very helpful.
Yeah, I wish I had thought it up when I was a student. All right, how much time we got? We've got half an hour. Just trying to think, should we practice some binary? I think we might just at least discuss the concepts anyway. I know this frightens people. But it's probably worth spending about 15 minutes on it, and then we can have a look at the quiz and go home early or something. How do you think? Any objections? Okay, so let's have a look at the... Silence is a stern reply. I think everyone's out there going, oh, I don't want any more of this, but we'll see if we can make it at least interesting for you. Okay, we know that a binary, we know that an octet, if we look at a number in binary, we're talking about eight lots of ones and zeros, okay? We know that we can have, they're all based on powers, and we can go to 2 to the power of 1, 2 to the power of 1 is a number, and 2 to the power of 4 is a number, 2 to the power of 8 is a number, 2 to the power of 16 is a number, etc. Sorry, I'm making this wrong. I'm going to cut that out and do it again. 2 to the power of 1, 2 to the power of 3. I'm looking at my spreadsheet and getting confused. So we know that 2 to the power of 3 is 8, and 2 to the power of 4 is 16. So we can see that the numbers are running from 2 to the power of 1 is always going to be 1. 2 to the power of 2 is going to be 2 times 2, which will be 4. And 2 to the power of 3 is going to be 2 times 2 times 2, which is going to be 8. 16, 32, 64, and 128, okay? So 2 to the power of 7 is going to be 128, which we've seen those numbers around. And when you get used to working these numbers, you get to see them. It's because it's 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times, and I'm running out of 2 times 2s. So that's where we're going to stop. We don't have to worry about 256, which, if anyone knows, 2 to the power of 8. Okay, so if that's the case, if we have a number of, say, 192, for example, which is a common number, okay? 192, we see this in Class C addresses all the time. We are going to work out its binary equivalent. Okay, so the way we do it is that we go, okay, with our eight numbers here, which range from on the right-hand side from 0 up to 128, we're going to put down, if we want to convert 192 to binary, we're going to actually put down a 1 in the 128s column, because we can start from the left. Now, the reason we do that is because we always pick the number available, the first number, or the highest number that's lower, that we pick the first number that's closest to 192. So the next highest number, which the next highest number is actually in this instance 128. Okay, so now that we put a 1 down, in the 128th column, and then we go, okay, our first number was 192, and we go 192 minus that number, which is 128. So 192 minus 128 is what, Narissa?
64, is that right?
Yep, that's exactly right. So we go 192 minus the first number that we're able to use in our chart, which is, and the difference between those is 64, okay? So then we put down a 1 in the 64s column, because 2 to the power of 6 is 64. And because there's nothing else for us to do, what do we put in number? When there's nothing to do in a column, what do you put?
Zero.
There you go. So if you put zeros in the columns that we have nothing to do with, what do you think the rest of that number's going to be?
All zeros.
Well, except for the first two bits. So you'll have a number.
Oh, sorry,
of
I thought
one,
you meant
one.
That said.
Yeah, well, I did say the rest of the numbers. So, yeah, grammatically, you are correct. So the rest of the number will all be all zeros. So as a result, you'll have two bits. Which is the first two columns set to 1 and the remaining 6 set to 0. Now, let's convert 168 to binary and see what we get. Okay, here we go. Let's have a look. Hang on, I just want to count my columns here. Okay, 168. Let's have a look at 168. 168, the nearest number to that, 168, is going to be 128, would you agree?
128?
Yep. So 168 minus 128 is what? Yeah, I get 40.
40.
Do you get 40? Yep. Okay. So we're going to put down a 1 in the 128th column, which we do. So because we have 40, we've skipped one of our common numbers. One of our nice common numbers is 64. So when there's a column with nothing to do in it, what do we put?
Zero.
Beautiful. Yep, zero. So we put zero in the second column because we've got nothing to do here. And we know that we're left with 40. So then we go, our next common number is 32. So then you go, well, I can do something here. So I'm going to put a one in that column. So because we've hit one of the numbers that we can actually work with, it's the first highest number that's not lower than the figure of 40, because that's what we're left with. So we put down our one in that column. So then we go, all right, well, what's 40 minus that number, which is 32? What's 40 minus 32?
Eight.
Yep, I got 8 too. How about that? Good. We all went to the same school. I sincerely hope not. So, which means there was nothing to do in the 16s column, so we put a what?
Zero.
Yep. So we hit upon our 8 because it's the column that we could do something with, and we stick our 1 in there. I therefore have got to the end of the run, so there's nothing to do in the 4 column, the 2 column, or the 1 column, so I again put 0, and I get a number of 10101000. How's that sound going? All right, so let's go
back.
Sounds
right to me.
Sounds pretty cool, hey? All right, so let's go back the other way. I won't worry about. I just thought I'd muck around with the Class C address, but I won't bother converting. You know, usually your home networks are 192.168.1 with maybe 0 or 1, and then, you know, 1, 2, or 3 above that on the fourth octet. So let's go and get that 161. Zero figure, and let's see how we can convert that back to 168. 168. Want to have a go, anyone?
You'd add up 128 and 64 because they're the only columns that have got numbers in them. Is that right?
Well, almost. Almost. That would get you what?
192.
Did you say 64? No. Well, that's 192. I'm converting out the. That's right. That's I'm converting out the 168 number because I didn't want to make one that easy. But yeah, if you were converting out 192, that's what you'd do. In this instance, we've actually got a bit more complex than that. We've actually got some more numbers here. We've got one in the 128s column, one in the 32s column, because we decided before that, you know, we had to deal with 40 for a bit. And then we said, oh, what's our nearest number to 40? And that was 32. So we stuck down a number there. And then we decided that, you know, the difference between 40 and 32 was 8. So we decided to stick a number in the 8s column. And, of course, all those other columns we do nothing with. So we stick zeros in there. So nothing equals 0. So, therefore, we end up with 3 ones in this particular number. And they are in the 28s, the 32s, and the 8s column. Is that making sense?
Yep. Add them all
so
together.
So if you were then, so you just add up all the powers that you've used. In other words, you add up, you go 128 plus 32.
It's 160.
Yep, equals 160. Will you shut up, please, phone? Spoil my thunder, why don't you? Okay, so we go 128 plus 64. 128 plus 32, because that's where we've got our ones. We get 160. And where there's another number is our 8 column, and I'm really sorry the phone went off then because it sort of messed the flow of it up. So we've got a number in the 128th column, a number in the 32's column, and a number in the 8's column. So what do? You simply add up 128 plus 32 plus 8, and you get 168. So making sense, you just add up all the columns that have got that have got ones in them. So, and this applies to any number. If you just picked a number out of the air, for example, like the number 50, if you wanted to convert any number, not necessarily these common ones that we're seeing come up in IP addresses, for example, if you wanted to see the decimal number 50, for example, 50, and you convert and you wanted to do that on the chart, you'd simply use the same technique. You would simply go, 50 minus, the nearest number you can work with is 32. So you go, like, all right, what's 50 minus 32? You put a 1 in that column, obviously. And then I think I get 18, if I remember rightly. Would you agree, Narissa, the maths teacher's daughter?
Yes, I think so. Oh, I didn't inherit her maths talent, I can assure you.
Okay, so we come up with a number of 18 and we go, what's the nearest number we can work with that, which is 16. So we stick a 1 in that column and we know that what's 18 minus 16 is going to be 2. So we look for the nearest column that we can work with. Oh, it just happens to be a 2. Wow, there you go. Stick a 1 in the 2's column and you've got it made. And you've got a binary number of 110010. Now, let's turn that back into a decimal number. Can anyone suggest, remember, we just add up the powers that have got, we just add up the columns that have got stuff in them. So is there a number in the 32's column?
Yes.
Is there a number in the 16 column?
Yes.
Okay, is 32, and what's 32 and 16?
48.
Yep, and is there a number in the 2's column?
Yes.
And what's 48 plus 2?
50.
There you go, easy. It's really easy to convert back from binary to decimal if you use a chart. Now, the inherent difficulty here is that Mr. Ian Murray, or Dr. Ian Murray, as he is now, made us all wonderful pegboards. And you could do all this sort of stuff ad nauseum on the pegboard. The only thing is they're made out of wood. So I said to Kim, I will be quite happy to tell her father how to make one day, if they're ever interested, if she wants to do advanced stuff. But yeah, that's basically what it is. The plans for the pegboards are up on the QCAT server somewhere. And we can't really send them out to different countries because of customs restrictions and all sorts of things. But yeah, I wish I had one when I was a student. So I just made a spreadsheet up. I could give anyone the spreadsheet if they want it. I've got a rather colourful spreadsheet here. It works rather well if you've got vision, but could work rather well if you've got no vision. It depends on how good your draw skills and things are with it. All right, well, that's the binary bit. I don't really want to go on about it. It does say to use the Windows calculator in the worksheet, but to be quite frank about it, I think a lot of people, particularly dealing with big numbers in a quick environment, would probably feel more comfortable checking them on the calculator anyway. However, having to do it manually for the A-plus exams, I think, is a requirement. Now, one other gotcha before I progress from this, and then I will leave it alone for sure. In the instance of our number 50 that we converted to and fro, we were only using 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 columns. So we had 2 bits there that we weren't writing down. In the number 50, if we were doing this in addressing, for example, would be obviously 00110010. It is important, particularly when you're doing the ending in advanced subneeding, and just in generally, really, put the leading zeros in. Even if you're messing around with a number that might have the first 5 bits or the first 2 bits or the first 7 bits all set to zero. I know it can look a bit odd, but it helps for lining it up, particularly being vision impaired. Jackie has written a wonderful script I can give people that allows you to do all this in Notepad if you hold the Alt key down, and Marshall would remember this from our dual scripting course, whereby if you hold the Alt key down and press the, and Kim, you'd remember this, I think we've used it in one of our other projects, hold the Alt key down and press the up arrow key, it reads you the number on the cursor, so you can get an idea of your columns. So if you're lining up binary numbers on one on top of the other, for example, you can see the columns and see here the full stops. As you, if you're sort of sitting on the full stop, you can hold the Alt key down and press the up or down arrow, rather than, as everybody knows, the first thing that happens with JAWS is that if you press down, you go down a line, for example, you hear it rattle off the whole line and it makes no sense at all, particularly if all you're hearing is ones and zeros. All right, gang, how are we all feeling? Brains fried yet?
Yes.
All right, good-o. That's it. I'm leaving. I'm not going to even mention the word binary for the rest of this class. There you go. All right, we have 15 minutes to go. I actually got that down in just over 15 minutes. Wow, how's that? Even with the phone call from Vicky. All right, look, I'll just have a quick look at this quiz. I'm not even sure how well. I sort of had a glance of it yesterday. How are you coping there, Pat?
Doing fine. Really enjoying it.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I hope it makes some sense. How are you going, Kim?
I need to study.
You do, dear. We'll help you out. I just remember what a rotten mongrel of a job I had of it when I was a student, so I fully appreciate that.
Oh, it's an absolute pain.
Yeah, how are you going, Narissa? Well, you've passed the test, but so you obviously know something.
The exam was an absolute stinker, and they put in all these sort of, instead of having you 192.168, they put in all these sort of more unusual, more tricky sort of addresses, and it really threw me.
Oh, okay.
Just to warn you guys.
go through the exam. I want to say go through the exam. I don't know. It's sort of. I haven't seen it for a year, so I couldn't tell you. There is a quiz here. I'm just wondering what's going to be more prudent. Let's have a look. While I just skim through the questions to see how they read and whether it's prudent to give them, are you able to tell people about the exam, Narissa, that without giving the answers away, but just sort of say the sorts of things you think you might need to study up on? Because you know, it was 12 months ago since I've seen the exam, so you're able to do
I'm
a little segment
I'm just trying to think,
before?
But I sort of got so rattled that it's hard for me to remember exactly what was in it. There was one question that asked whether a certain address, which it gave a network address, and it said which of the other addresses, like it gave four alternative networks and you had to say which network it was on. But it was confusing because I can't remember why it was confusing now, but I looked and looked at them and got more sort of rattled as time went on.
That's all right.
There was another question which said that if you were on the phone to a friend, was it a unicast, multicast, simulcast or broadcast?
Yep.
It was just... it's sort of like a blur to me now because the more I thought about it, the more I actually thought I'd failed. And the first number that came up on the screen where Zoom text was focused was a 44, and I thought, I failed. I'm just trying to think. It's all to do with, you know, like you have to know or you ask questions about the DHCP server. They seem to have a million different network addresses that you had to give answers about. I wish I could remember better, but you know, I hate sitting exams and I just get sort of it's all a blur now.
I bet you there's one thing you do remember about it.
That it was horrible.
Oh, that too. The sigh of relief that you probably got when after you pressed the grade exam button and it came back with your score.
Yeah, especially when I saw 44 and I thought, oh no, I failed. Luckily, I was looking at the wrong number and it was 84.
Oh, I wasn't going to share that with the class. But
sorry, I wasn't sure.
No, you're welcome to. It's your personal information. No, you. If you want to tell people you got 84% in an exam, be my guest. But no, good on you. Well done. I think you did very well. Congratulations. But if anyone wants to share their exam results, it's their personal prerogative to do so. All right, well, let's have a quick look at the quiz. I'm only going to give you half the quiz. There you go. And let's have a look. Okay, and you guys, I'm going to do this as the first answer. And you can just go yes and no verbally because I can't alt-tab back. So if you just want to yell yes and no, that's fine. Or unless you don't want to be heard on the thing. Maybe you just use the chat. Actually, it's probably better. We'll use the chat. I'll just have to bring up the chat window here. This is where it's really good when I'm working with Kylie, for example, because one of us can give the credits. All right. The first thing is basically I'm going to give some devices here that will require that may or may not require an IP address, or that will require an IP address. So the question is, a technician is setting up equipment. Which three devices will need IP addresses? Which three? So you can just go yes and no for this sort of stuff. So the first device is a printer with an Ethernet card. Yes or no? Does it require an IP address? Any other takers? Okay, for the three out of the four of you who got that question, you are all correct. Why is correct? Because the network card has the network card inside the network printer has an IP address. What about a web camera that's directly connected to a host? Yep, and the people answering no, because it's connected to a host, are correct. It doesn't have a network interface. Oh, here's a good one. A server with two NICs. And everyone answered yes. Why? And you're all correct in doing so. An IP telephone. Does that require an IP address? Yep, everybody who answered why, which is everybody, you are correct. A standalone workstation. Okay, somebody got that answer wrong. Everybody answering N is correct. And the reason is because it's a standalone workstation. It's not connected to anything. So it's not going to need an IP address. Next one's a bit of a curly one for you, but let's see how you go with it. This is devices that require an IP address, or things that do. A PDA attached to a network workstation. And the person answering yes, I would, I would agree with, because it's attached to a network workstation. There's an example of English teachers getting at it, because people see or hear the word network and go, Maybe it does require an IP address, but no, it's if it's attached to the workstation, it's probably using its client software like, you know, Nokia Suite or Apple, iTunes or something. So there you go. Now, I'm going to skip this one because it's going to be hard to read, although it's a really good one about binary octets. Let's see. Which statements are true about binary octets? Yes, I will read it. Okay. If a bit is zero, its column value is not counted. Is that true or false? That's correct. It's not. Hang on. It's double negatives here. Hang on. I'm getting confused. Its column value is not. I'd say its column value is counted, to be honest. The value of each bit in an octet is twice that of the bit to its right. It's an interesting question. A bit in an octet, is it true to say that it's twice that of the value to the bit to its right? Yep, the people who are answering yes, you are correct, which is most of you, all of you. The right-hand bit of an octet has a value of zero when it is turned on. Is that true or false? People answering no or false, you are correct. Oh, here's a good one. If all of the bits in an octet is set to one, the value of the octet is set to 256. Yes, well done. Everybody who's getting in is correct, because the value of the octet is 255. Because you start at zero, so that's a good curly one. Yes, you've got 256 possible values. But it starts at zero, so therefore the first thing you can have is zero. So, yep, 255. Okay. Now, what else is true? There are 32 value positions in an octet. Everyone getting no, you are correct. There's 32 bits to an address and 8 bits to an octet. So there you go. Anyone who answered false to that question, which is most of you, you are correct. Match the number of the first octet to the corresponding address class. That's going to be a mongrel to read, so I'm not going to do it, although it's a really good question. Which statement is true concerning private network addresses? Okay, statement one. They are always routed on the internet. True or false? Ooh, 50% of you got that wrong. People answering true, you are incorrect. Which statement is true concerning private internet, private network addresses? They are always routed on the internet. No, absolutely not. That's why we have network address translation. Okay, another statement about... which statement is true about private network addresses? Let's see if this one is. They can only be used by one company at a time. True or false? That's right. They can be used by many companies, so therefore that is false. They enable what? They enable web servers to be what? They enable web servers to be easily accessed by outside users. I don't like that way the question's worded, and I've probably mangled it up. The answer to that question is actually false. So the correct answer, well, we'll see, there's only going to be one correct one now, and it is this one. They are more secure as they are only visible to the local network. Go now. True, exactly. So everyone answering T or yes is true, that is correct. Those addresses are more secure because they're only available to the local network. I think that's probably about it, gang. Yeah, there's four statements in correct category. I'm never going to be able to read that out. It's just not going to work too well. So, folks, here, end of the lecture. Well done. Congratulations. You've got past the second hump in the Discovery 1 curriculum. Well done to all of you. And also well done to those of you who are listening in listener land. Give yourselves a big pat on the back, gang. All right, anybody there? Oh, have we cooked everyone's brains?
Yes, we're here.
Thanks, Larissa.
Yeah, I'm sort of here.
You're sort of here?
I'm here.
Hi, Kim. How are you going? Hi, Pat. Hi, Kim. You sort of had enough for today, Marshall, you think?
Well, I'm probably going to try and take the exam tonight, so I haven't had enough, but I've had enough for now.
Good luck.
Good luck. Yeah, and I'll get that Module 3 exam fixed for you too. I'll have to look at that later today. Sorry about that. Well, good stuff. I'm glad you've all come through. Well, thanks everybody for your time. The next lesson's good, and I was debating whether to break that up into a two-parter. I'll think on that. I may not, though, depending on time constraints. For my personal life, etc., happening here as to whether I can afford that extra week. I sort of wouldn't mind doing it, but we'll just have to see what happens. The next chapter is a really good one. It concerns the OSI, or Open Systems Interconnect model, OSI model. It's what I really think the whole course ought to be based around in the first instance. And when you've studied the OSI model, it will actually pull a lot of stuff together for you. And there's a school of thought that I really subscribe to as well that genuinely believes it's not taught early enough in this course. It was taught early in the old CCNA course, and it is also taught early in, I think, Chapter 2, I think it is, or similar in the Discovery 2 course. I can see why they've left it a bit late, but I think for some of the things, particularly for novices, learning off the differences between bits and bytes and stuff with Chapter 3 stuff, when we were talking about switches and hubs and that sort of stuff, and MAC addresses, and now we're talking about IP addressing and stuff like that and routers and things in this chapter here, I really think the OSI reference model has its place to come in a little bit earlier. It's a very, very interesting chapter, and we'll make the whole thing drop, bring a lot more of it and tie a whole lot more of it together. In that chapter, we also deal with ports, and some of you may already be familiar with certain port addresses. Of, you know, common ones like, you know, SMTP being port 25 and HTTP being port 80 and all that sort of stuff, and we discuss the importance of knowing all about that. So lots more to stay tuned for. It gets really interesting from here, and believe it or not, in my opinion, the next four chapters get a damn sight easier. There you go. You're over the hump. That's it. You're in the home run now. The next four chapters get easier.
Well, have a good weekend. Weekend for.
Good luck with the exam, Marshall.
Yeah, good luck, Marshall. Good luck, everybody. Thanks for attending, and we'll look forward to seeing you all again same time next week. Bye for now.